fighting does not mean that your case is dead or your position is like stale or bad or whatever. Like, you still are strategizing. Every time you communicate with him, if he's an abuser, guess what? That's evidence. Every single email that I had with my ex was evidence against him. I could email him, the sky is blue, and he'd be like, F you, die in a ditch, you suck, you're the worst mother ever. I mean, that's evidence. Mm-hmm.
There is times where you cut bait and run. Like, you just get out. And sometimes that means you don't walk away with everything that you should be entitled to. But I go back to Jake, and you've heard me say this before. Peace is priceless. The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. What happens when a protective mother's fight in family court turns into a mission to help others navigate the same system? Today, we're welcoming Courtney Gilmartin, the founder of Monarch Consulting Group, to help us answer that particular question. After facing adversity in the family court, Courtney transformed that experience into purpose. With nearly 20 years of cross-industry experience solving complex problems and bringing order to chaos, she created the Monarch Method, a framework designed to turn lived experience into clear, structured evidence so clients can advocate for themselves with confidence and control. Her mission is simple. No protective parent should walk into family court without the tools to make their truth heard. Let's dive in. Courtney, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Courtney, can we hear your origin story?
I feel like I've always been a little bit of a outspoken wild card to a degree looking back, but I think that served me well. So I went to college after high school, obviously, but I was so bored. I was in business school and I'm like, this is so boring. I can be making real money in the real world. So I quit, bought a business. My parents thought I was nuts. I like gave them this whole presentation. I'm like, you need to refinance your house and give me money to buy a tanning salon. They're like, you're insane.
I love it.
But it happened. So I was there for 10 years, got married in the interim, had both my kids. My babies were playing cars in like one of the tanning rooms that I wouldn't use when they were there. I raised them there. It taught me so much though, owning a business. And I was there 7 days a week for almost a decade. Sold that when I got divorced. Michelle, you probably understand why.
I do. I very much do.
So that was, had to sell that. But it was time, you know, I learned what I needed to learn. The industry changed tremendously. And then after that, I was approached to kind of enter the startup world. Given my background, they're like, well, if you, you know, you're a business owner, we need you on the startup side. We need operations and strategy help. So I worked for a company most people know, Rent the Runway. I was there for a long time. And then I left there and I was with a smaller company called The Yes that Pinterest ended up acquiring. And The Yes was super small. We were a strong but mighty team. But throughout my, you know, more corporate journey, I was self-taught. And I guess you learn through fire hose sometimes, like, how do I streamline chaos? How do I make messy projects into streamlined plans that, you know, the executives want to hear, like deliverables and how we're doing and KPIs and performance. So I had to quickly learn how to do that. So I took that experience when I entered family court and my divorce was settled probably like 13 months or so. It really wasn't that long.
It's not that bad, but it really is not.
No, only because I think my business background gave me the insight to be able to know that I was literally just pissing money into a toilet. I was throwing money into the wind to fight.
Yep.
We kind of got in and out of the divorce process relatively quickly. It was after the divorce that SHIT really hit the fan. I mean, and it just hit the fan. So post separation abuse, if you will, or post-settlement litigation, whatever, however you want to frame it. That's when things really ramped up. And I kind of had to sit down and have like a come to Jesus talk with myself. And I'm like, what you're doing isn't working. So you need to figure out a better approach to this. You're smarter than this. You're better than this. Like, what is happening? So that's when I was like, I need to put my business hat on. I need to take the emotion out of the equation.
Yep.
Family court and family law is so emotionally driven. And it's so easy to get sucked into it, obviously. It's your children. It's your livelihood. It's, you know, they will mudsling and make up rumors about you. I mean, it's sometimes your reputation, your dignity, everything. So I really looked at kind of how I was digesting information at work on the corporate side and how I was project planning and how I was giving information to my third party partners or cross-functionally. How was I running meetings with people when we had these huge projects that were like thrown together and it was so messy and we were getting information from all different angles? And I'm like, I need to apply some of those same strategies in my divorce, because I had, you know, my lawyer, he had his lawyer, we had a PC, we had therapists, then we had a forensic evaluator. We had all these different people with their hands in our case. Everyone wanted information.
Yep.
How was I giving people that information in a succinct, organized, digestible way? And how was I also, I think a big miss for a lot of people is like family law attorneys, GALs, parent coordinators, forensic evaluators, you know, they see the same kind of story over and over again all day. I hate my ex. He's an abuser. I hate my ex-wife. She's holding the kids from me. He's the worst person in the world. No, you don't understand. She's the worst person in the world. So it's like, how do I present my case in a way that makes it stand out and makes it really be different from everybody else, where someone is going to stop and look at it and be like, no, you know what? Something here is something's going on. This needs to be handled differently, because this is not like all the other cases where we hear the same thing over and over. I mean, it sounds so simple, but I just dug into my tools. Like I was like, what tools do I have in my toolbox that I can utilize? This doesn't, let's make it simple. Sometimes the most simple thing is the best answer. What can I do? I'm like, I'm going to make a spreadsheet. I'm going to make a timeline. I'm going to put dates in chronological order. And this is not groundbreaking, but this is literally what I did one day. I was like, I'm going to take all the events that have happened that are effed up, and I'm going to put it in order, and I'm going to link the proof right to it. And I'm going to send it to my lawyer, and I'm going to see what he says.
Yep. And the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid.
Right. So we called and he's like, oh my God, this is great. Can you do this again?
Yeah.
We're going to put this in a motion. And then I was kind of like, okay, you know, and then things go on and things happen in the case when you're like super high conflict and everybody's fighting and you're like in a PC meeting once a week about everything, whatever.
And PC could be a couple of things, parenting coordinator, parenting coach. What was PC in your particular vernacular?
So we had a parent coordinator.
Okay.
And at the time in New Jersey, they were kind of just like a mediator and they would give recommendations, but the recommendations weren't binding. Correct. Now in New Jersey, their recommendations are binding.
When did that change? Because we have parenting coordinators in Texas and their stuff is not binding.
So it's binding. I don't want to misspeak on when those changes were made. They were made after I no longer had a PC. And now I've had two, because my first PC, my ex... Well, he tried to fist fight him in the parking lot after a meeting.
Your ex tried to fist fight the parenting coordinator?
Yes.
Well, that was smart on his part. Not. Did he get arrested?
No.
Okay.
No. And then my attorney joined the firm where the PC was, joined the PC's firm. So then they flipped out. He's a conflict. He can't be your attorney anymore. He can't be the PC anymore. So we had to get rid of him and get a new PC.
So your PCs in New Jersey are attorneys?
They are.
That's interesting.
They're family law attorneys, which they can now be also mental health providers.
Usually for us are mental health providers. I don't know that I've ever seen a PC that is an attorney. I think the price would probably agree to one, but.
A majority of them are, which is problematic for a few reasons. Mostly because they're just so busy that I have clients who like use PCs and then 5 minutes before the meeting that they've been prepping for, they're like, yeah, you're called into court. I have an emergency motion, whatever.
Yeah.
So it's hard. But when they made the changes where PCs made binding recommendations, they've made a lot of changes in Jersey where they're trying to keep people out of court constantly. And they're trying to reduce motion practice just because it's so cumbersome and time consuming.
Yeah.
And it clogs up the courts, as you know.
Uh-huh.
So they changed the PC rules. They changed who can become a PC. And then they changed it where it's a binding recommendation. And if you don't agree with the recommendation, you have to file
a motion. You have to file a motion to object to it. Right.
Do people listen?
No.
Really?
No.
But it does help victims if you're dealing with someone who's coercively controlling, or there's a lot of conflict, or they're just abusive after you separate. And you have, let's say, a third party that's supposed to make binding recommendations, even if they don't make binding recommendations and they're supposed to make recommendations, and that person is supposed to help reduce conflict.
Yeah.
And the other party isn't complying with that process. I tell people, Yes, it's frustrating. Yes, it's a waste of money. Yes, it can be a waste of time. But in the end, it probably will serve you in a way, because you can go to the court or you can go to the evaluator or you can go to whomever and be like, this doesn't work. So we can't keep doing this. It's an exercise of utility.
You know, and that's, I think, part of what litigants in family law miss, because what they want at that immediate time is that person to be held accountable immediately. And the Italians will say revenge is best served cold. Sometimes you let them dig their hole, you let them sink their ship, because that immediate, like the immediate gratification that you think you're going to get in court, if at the moment they don't follow the parenting coordinator, that's not going to carry the day. What carries the day is when you go to court at final trial and say, let's look at the behavior that's occurred over the course of this case, judge, because you want to show me, it's kind of like the lines of, show me who your friends are, show you who you are. It's the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. And judge, if this person is doing this while under the watchful eye of the court, while under the watchful supervision of third parties appointed by the court as extensions of the court, judge, can you imagine what's going to happen when you all are gone?
Yep. And I tell people that's like the mindset shift that some litigants need to get into for long-term strategic planning.
Yep.
Like, you know what? If he gets a slap on the wrist right now, it may actually backfire for you, because these coercive controllers, abusers, domestic violence perpetrators, whatever label you want to give them, they're very smart. They're very manipulative. They're very cunning. And I don't mean smart as like a compliment, but they're not dumb because they know what they're doing, right? So if they get yelled at or reprimanded for not complying, guess what? They're probably going to start complying.
They'll change their behavior. Exactly.
Right. They're going to kick the can down the road, and then you're going to have to scramble and figure out, how can I prove XYZ? Let them wave their crazy flag. Let them show who they really are. Because you know what? That's going to help you down the road. Like, we had the first PC in my case. He didn't listen. He didn't comply. He would write scathing emails about me to the PC and me. Courtney's a piece of shit. She's an awful mother. Look at her. She's terrible. And I'm like, Okay. And my lawyer kind of said the same. My first lawyer would always say the same thing you said. He's like, Courtney, the higher he climbs, the harder he's going to fall. So let him keep doing that.
You give them the rope. Like, here you go, buddy. Here's, or girl. I mean, because they'll both genders do it, but it's, but it's very much, here's the rope. Go hang yourself. And they do. And the problem is, if you try and catch them and get them punished midstream, then when you get to final trial, the argument from opposing counsel is going to be, judge, we've already addressed that. We don't need to talk about that again. So your hammer's gone.
Yeah. So he kept doing that, my ex. Nothing mitigated the conflict. We had a PC, then we got another PC, then we had family therapy, family counseling, where he and I had to go together, and he was just as awful. So then we get to the forensic evaluation finally. 6 years post-settlement, we did forensic evaluation. Everyone's like, oh my God, how did you wait? I'm like, again. If we would have gone after, they probably would have ordered all these services. They would have recommended things to mitigate conflict and been like, we'll see how it goes. I waited 6 years. My kids were older. They had lived 6 years of nonstop insanity. I mean, I'm sure you know just the things that can go on in a case like this. Every holiday was an issue. Birthdays were an issue. I mean, I had to get a freaking court order to let my kids go to my sister's wedding because it fell on his weekend.
Jake just had an expression on his face, and I have to tell you, that is so not uncommon, Jake. I can't even tell you. Like, it's, I've had to go get a court order so kids could attend a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Let me ask you both
this. Control.
The lack of rationality with these bad actors, right? People, former significant others of yours. How does it get to the point where you have to get a court order to attend something as important as a funeral?
Because there's a court order that gives them possession that if you violate, you can be held in contempt of court. So unless you get their agreement, you can't do anything about it. And so the only option is to go get a court order.
Also, one step further than that, because like you would think logic would just prevail, like I could just take the kids and go because the divorce police aren't going to come after me. And, you know, Lake Placid, where the wedding was, which is true. But my ex was the type where he went one step further. He went into our family wizard, put in vacation on the one day of the wedding, and then wrote an email to the school and was like, they're not going to be in school because we're going away.
Yep.
And that didn't happen. We didn't get that far, but he would have kept the kids home from school. So I couldn't have taken them to Lake Placid for my sister's wedding if it had gotten that far. Yes. Yep. 100%.
Do these people care at all about the impact that it's going to make on the children?
They truly cannot see past their own rage. And that's the barrier to co-parenting in these situations. They cannot see past their need for truly revenge at all costs. And that's it.
So I think that is part of it. Absolutely. There's another part of it because I do think that there are some times where these individuals think they're doing the right thing.
Oh, yeah.
That's the other part of the psychology is at some point they're like, well, no, I'm protecting them. They don't need to go to the funeral because they don't need to see death yet. I mean, that's so part of it is also they think they're protecting the child.
But the method they're using, though, this is the whole thing. When the child sees somebody lash out, when the child sees somebody basically stake revenge on their other parent, how does that method even remotely help about their original point? Meaning that, oh, maybe they shouldn't see a funeral. But in this case, how much does it take to get to that point where the child sees them completely being irrational and bottom line abusive at times?
So the kids, in a lot of cases, don't see it because it's just the communications between the parents. And so in most scenarios, the kids should not be exposed. That being said, the older the kids get, the more exposed they get because kids, anything past, I'll say 10, because my 10-year-old tries to read over my shoulder for every text message I send. Who are you on the phone with? Who are you talking to? What's that? I mean, so they get to a point where the kids want to know what's going on. And so when you get to that point, then the kids get involved, but they don't care. That's the problem. They just, I don't know if it's a switch where they just flip it and they're like, F it. Because it's about the battle. It's about the control. It's about, I'm not going to let them win. And no one wins and only the kids lose.
It's like they also, to like pile on to Michelle's point, they think they're doing the right thing because they feel victimized.
Yep.
So they feel justified in what they're doing or what they do because they're the victim. And even when the kids do start to know, because like in my case, of course, my kids knew about my sister's wedding. They're hearing conflicting narratives from both houses where it's like, well, mom's just, you know, mom always tries to steal my time and I planned a vacation and mom is just so evil. And, you know, your aunt could have planned her wedding any other day. And granted, logic would prevail that is not a viable argument. But like when your kids are 5 and 7, they're like, well, yeah, why didn't Katie plan another day? And like, they play on the kids' emotions. They make the kids feel bad for them. And depending on the kid's personality and depending on the dynamic and depending on so many things, which is why these cases are so complex, depends on how that victim mentality will be received. One of my kids really does not buy the BS. And another one does. They feel bad. He's the victim.
And they want it to be fair. Kids want it to be fair. Kids in divorce in particular have this sense of, well, it just needs to be fair between the parents. And so the one parent will feed into, it's not fair. It's not fair your mom is taking away my time. It's not fair your dad is taking away my time. And so it comes down to that too.
It's this really special trip I planned and this is the only day we can go. And there's like a leprechaun with a rainbow and he's gonna clown. You know, it's just like the insanity, you cannot make it up. But that's the stuff that goes on.
I mean, Jake, I'm not kidding. That is so textbook what I deal with day in and day out. And then the other part of the abusive part of it, which is what drives me nuts. You have to file the motion. You got to set a hearing. You have to confer with opposing counsel about a hearing date. That's all expensive and adds up with the cost. And then they will take it up to the day of trial or the day of the hearing and then agree. Because then they don't look like the bad person in front of the judge and the judge never hears that they had to do all these things to get this agreement. And then when you get to court and they agree before court, you don't care because you just got the agreement. You're done. And you don't get the hammer.
Yep. And that's part of the plan too.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of variances in this and you both have made good points on for both sides of this, right? My question is this, is that do you feel a lot of these bad actors in the way that they're carrying out certain things, most likely if there weren't children involved, they would find something else to use as a way to cause conflict or potential revenge against their ex?
Yes.
100%. They just pick a new pawn.
The kids, unfortunately, and again, I would not trade it for anything. I love my children. The kids, I've been in other relationships where there were bad actors and I didn't see it until they started to act bad and then I ended it. There's no more overlap. There wasn't that prolonged interaction. The grief wasn't as bad. The abuse wasn't as bad because there's nothing tying me to them. That's it. It's over. You know, the amount of healing that I did after really was fully dependent on me. And I'm not victim blaming. I'm just saying like I had to choose to end that relationship and move on. And that was my decision, but he had no access to me anymore because there was nothing there. The kids are the conduit and family court is like gasoline on that fire.
When it comes to, Jake, and you're talking about like what do they do when there's no kids? So what I see is the cases where they've got joint owned businesses, and this goes into why Courtney did what she did with hers. When you have to do a business buyout where you owe them money, if there is something that leashes you to that person, they will absolutely use that leash instead. So whether it's the kids, whether it's financial, that's why when you do divorces in particular that you've got this type of character, man or woman, you try to draft the decree so that, or fashion an agreement, if you can do an agreement, where it severs all ties other than kids, right? You can't sever the kids' ties, but everything else has to be severed. Otherwise, you allow that leash to continue forever, or for like if a spousal maintenance has to be paid or alimony has to be paid. Like there are leashes that stay in that facilitate their ability to control and create chaos because their goal is to create chaos.
This is a question for both of you. Let's say somebody's in a position where they have children with an a soon-to-be ex, right? They're considering divorce. What would you tell them both to expect from this point on once you decide, okay, I'm going to go through with filing divorce. I'm going to let my soon-to-be ex know this. What kind of tips would you let them know about what to potentially be prepared for in a situation like this?
I'm going to let Courtney go first because her advice will probably be a little bit different than mine because mine's more on the legal side.
I would say, first of all, like get out of your head that you're on a timeline because you're not. The timeline is for you to decide, no one else, right? So I tried to leave a few times when my kids were really little and I just couldn't do it. Logistically, you know, I wasn't in a place career-wise. I wasn't making the money that I needed to make on my own. I knew I wasn't going to get help from him with that. My kids were so small, I didn't want to do that to them yet. I mean, I'll be transparent about that. Like, they were little. So I talked to lawyers. I got my options. Always talk to lawyers. Talk to more than one. Get your options. Take their advice and really sit on it. Ask the hard questions. Ask worst case scenarios so you get the answers and you know what you're up against. And then I started planning. You know, I really started to try to organize my evidence. Then it was a different ballgame. I was not as organized as I was now, obviously. I sold my business because I knew that was going to be a shit show in the divorce. So I did that.
Yep.
I tried to get my life together as much as possible. I researched, you know, houses, the housing market. I mean, and this is like, I feel like not groundbreaking advice again, but I really had to like basically plan my life over. So I was like, where do I want to live? What schools do I want my kids to go to? Where can I move that's going to give my kids the best quality of life? I didn't want to stay in the town that I was in. What is my childcare situation going to look like? I had to kind of plan all that out in my head. I didn't want to just jump without a net underneath me. And when I found an attorney I liked and it got to a point where I couldn't take it anymore because the fighting was just so bad, I left. I say to everybody, and I get some heat for this, and I'm curious Michelle's pushback, but like you get in and you get out of that divorce as quick as possible. As quick as possible with an agreement you can live with. Because guess what? At the end of the day, you're going to get all this advice where they're like, you need this in your parenting plan and you need this in your parenting plan and this and this. And I'm like, okay, and all of this and this is going to give them time to scheme up more crap and time to fight and money that you're just literally flushing down the toilet that they're probably not going to follow anyway. And I'm not saying that that's okay, But there are strategies and tools and things that you can do after the divorce where you can go back and modify. It's not easy. I get that. But it's also not easy to get a perfect agreement that everybody's happy with in the divorce. So like, what's the better option here? I would say getting divorced as quick as you can, as quick as humanly possible. Yeah.
As quickly as the courts will allow.
Right. And as quickly as you can get them
right.
to as well.
Right. Because a lot of times their goal is to extend litigation as long as possible. Quite often I come in on cases and my job is really to stop the bleeding, is to get it set for final trial and get that and get the case over with. Right. Because living in litigation is no way to live a life. I mean, it's just not. And it's not healthy for the individuals. It's not healthy for the kids. It's just not healthy for litigation to continue. And I've had divorces that have lasted 5 years. And not because we wanted them to, but I came in and we get them set for trial and get them done. Now, some of those took 2 years from the time I came in to get them done, but strategically, we had to that particular way. That being said, one of the things I often tell, and I agree with Courtney, is plan. There is no time frame. There is no, and Courtney, I'm going to get back to this with you on this because I'm actually curious. There's always one epic fight that is the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. I know I had one. I had that last colossal fight where I looked at him and I saw just the absolute anger in his eyes, and my kids were hearing it all. And I knew at that second, this is never going to change. And I walked out the door, and that was the end of it. So everyone has that proverbial moment. And it's hard to say that you will know, but you know. When you have that last, like, I'm done, then you can go. But planning is absolutely key. I also agree. Meet with several attorneys because the attorney-client relationship dictates what your life is going to be post-divorce. So you have to make sure that you have someone that you know is competent, has your back, and you get along with, right? Like the last thing you want is you dislike your attorney. Like don't just go hire, because this happens a lot. Don't go hire a male attorney because you think it has to be a man. Don't hire a female attorney because you want that female attorney to be a, you know what, to your soon to be ex, right? I understand there's strategies for people hire genders for their divorce attorneys, but you really need to find someone that knows what they're doing, understands how to navigate the system, is not going to blow smoke up your proverbial, you know what, because the reality is, as an attorney, our job is to be very blunt with our clients about here is the range of possibilities. Here is A, here is B, C, D, and E. And here's how we're going to get to either any of those letters. And this is the most efficient way to get your divorce done, right? That is our job. Often I will tell my clients, you may not like what I'm going to tell you, but I'm going to tell you to straight so that you understand what you're facing. Because I agree with Courtney to some extent. There is times where you cut bait and run. Like you just get out. And sometimes that means you don't walk away with everything that you should be entitled to. But I go back to Jake, and you've heard me say this before, peace is priceless. And planning your life is so accurate about you've got to figure out how to do it yourself, where you're going to live, schools. I mean, it's groceries, like your commute time, because you can only rely on yourself and taking care of your kids. What I often hear is that, well, what do you mean I can't force him to take the kids on his time? He or she, whoever has the non-custodial parent, has the right to exercise, not the obligation. And so when you get ones that are truly the controlling ones, you know what they do? They mess with your life and don't follow a court order schedule on possession or access, because that allows them to control you more. It's like, oh, no, I'm just going to pick them up for a couple of hours, have dinner with them, bring them back home. Why? So you can't have a dating life. You can't go on vacation. You can't plan your life around the possession schedule that the court laid out, because it's not, they don't mandatorily have to do it. It's if they choose to. And so you will find that the ones that are the abusive ones will choose not to follow the schedule to mess with your life. And so you have to plan, if you're the custodial parent, male or female, you have to plan to be the 100% full-time parent and be in charge of everything. And you have to prepare for that. Anything less, you're setting yourself up for failure, especially if you're leaving an abusive relationship.
Yep.
Oh, the other piece that I always tell people is do not expect their behavior to change. If they were this person while you were married, it's only going to get worse. They are not your buddy. They are not your friend, and they're not looking out for you.
Yeah, and you can start to emotionally detach even though you're physically there. I think that was a lot of it for me too. Like, I had to almost grieve the relationship and just know this is not the person I want to be with. To your point, like, there was a period of time where I was having some health issues and I ended up having some thyroid issues. I'd have surgery, and it was in the hospital when I remember looking at him and I was like, we're done. Because I was so sick from the anesthesia and the nurse was trying to get his attention. And on top of all the other crap he had done to me up to that point, he turned to her and it was like a bother. And I was like, we're done here. I'm not a bother. So I remember that day still, but I still physically wasn't ready to leave yet just because I had to get some, you know, my life in order. But it helped me because when I left, I wasn't crying over him. I wasn't sad about the divorce. Like, I wanted the divorce. I was done. So I needed to get to that point, and it helped because family court and all the proceedings, and we had some temporary restraining orders right away after the divorce, obviously. It helped me because I wasn't so emotionally invested in the relationship and trying to understand why. And I wasn't like calling my attorney like a puddle, like, oh my God, I'm so sad. Why is he doing this? I was like, we got to get out of this. We're done. I'm done. And that helped because it's so jarring. It's so emotional. It's such an emotional time for so many people. Like, you're dividing assets, you're selling your marital home, maybe you're splitting up your 401k, you're talking about splitting your kids and not seeing your kids on Christmas. And then on top of it, if you're mourning the relationship, it's a hard time for a lot of people that are getting divorced.
And especially for those that didn't see the divorce coming, right? They find out about the affair and then file for divorce. It is, you've got to take the emotions out of it, and which is why it's so important to have an attorney that does that for you. Like, I quite often will say, I'm your shield. Just need you to stand behind me. I'll take the hits. I'll take the blows. I'll tell you when to worry, because not every filing, not every motion, not every court hearing is something that is going to substantially affect your life one way or the other. Like, some of these are, don't worry about it, you know, because, and I know, Courtney, you've saw this in yours. They throw every allegation against you. And literally what they're doing, Jake, is they're throwing all the spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks. And so what happens is you get these pleadings that are inflammatory and full of lies. And it makes the person receiving it lose it because they're like, this isn't true. I need to prove X, Y, and Z. And how could they say that about me? Well, you can't stop someone from being an asshole who's an asshole. Let's just start with that premise, okay? But in addition to that, I always tell my clients, I'm like, well, is it true? Well, they're like, well, no. I'm like, well, then don't worry about it. I'm like, you can't stop them. So why lose sleep over something that you know is not true? If you know you're a good parent, you're a good parent. But then the problem is they've beaten your confidence down so low for so many years that you start to believe, well, maybe I am a bad parent. No. Go back to who you are. Do a deep dive and, you know, take account. And if you know you're a good parent, you know if you're the good mom, the good dad, the one that does all the doctor's appointments, all of the sporting events, if you're the room parent, like, you know what you have done as a parent. So let them throw the spaghetti, because what they want to do is get you to react in court, appear crazy, so they can say, look, judge, I'm right.
And distract from probably the real issue.
Correct.
You file something, or they file something that's a real issue. And then they're like, but wait, there's more. She's XYZ. Correct. And then you're talking about XYZ. And the real issue is left in the dust. And you're like, and then you leave the court hearing and you're like, wait, we didn't even settle the holiday schedule.
Right.
We were fighting over who takes the kid to Little League.
Right.
Which doesn't even matter.
Which doesn't even matter.
They didn't want the holiday schedule settled because they don't want to have to comply with rules. Yeah. And they want to torch your Christmas break.
Yep.
And that, like, you brought up a point where I will have my clients that work with me, literally, I'm like, all right, we're going to create a tracker for everything you do with your kids. We're going to call it parent participation tracker. And they're like, that seems so silly. I'm like, no, you're going to write down every class trip, every class party, every game, everything that you go to. And it seems silly. But guess what? When you get that motion that says you're a complete POS, derelict parent who doesn't do anything, you're going to spiral for a second, but then you're going to be like, wait a second. Mm-hmm. I have all the proof right here. Here's everything. No, yep. I'm not. And then you can move on.
Yeah.
And it has served my clients so well because they're like, Courtney, I would have completely spiraled if we didn't put that together.
Right. Because they do. You get those inflammatory filings in court, and y'all lawyers are really good at inflammatory words. You can ask my boyfriend. He will tell you that he's never going to engage in a word battle with me. Like, we're good at it. Okay. But that being said, it's designed to make you spin because in court, credibility of a witness is everything.
Yep.
And so if you are on that witness stand appearing to be the crazy person that they've said you are, you lose all credibility with the court and it makes what they're saying the court more likely to believe.
Right.
And so you just got to go back to, if it's not true, give them the middle finger. It's right. Okay. And next. But right. That is, and but it's difficult. And that's why I tell my clients, I'm like, I will tell you when to worry. And if it's not true, don't worry about it.
And that's why I'm like, we're going to ground ourselves in proof and evidence because you can't gaslight proof.
Nope.
You can't. You can try, but it's going to ground you. And I, you know, you hear all these people like, we're going to have tools that help us curb anxiety. We're going to breathe. We're going to do breath work. We're going to meditate, blah, blah. That goes out the window when you're in panic mode. And that's why I give my clients like tangible assets, whether it's a spreadsheet or a timeline or how, whatever format we do, it depends on the case. But at the crux of it, like the soup and nuts of it is we get all their raw evidence and we organize it in a cohesive way. And we'll have certain tags depending on their case and what they're trying to track and behaviors they're tracking. But that is literally an invaluable grounding tool because I'm like, go back to your proof. Look at it. Just reread it. No, that's not true. I have it right here. And it's so helpful because in the panic spiral, when you look at something fact-based and black and white, it really kind of can help people walk back off that ledge and reframes their brain into looking at like the truth of the matter and not all the allegations and the fakeness. And it helps my clients a lot. And I've gotten feedback from their attorneys, my clients' attorneys, where they're like, thank you for doing this because now I don't have to sort through 5,000 screenshots.
So it sounds like, Courtney, you would do a phenomenal job boarding potential clients for Michelle in this case, right? I mean, there's a real connection here when it comes to understanding and organizing evidence in a way that would save a lot of time and energy and focus in that way.
And that's my main goal. At first, I think some lawyers, when they heard the work I was doing, you know, and there's a ton of divorce coaches out there, and I hate that term. I hate it, and I'm not one. I'm a consultant, and I focus on strategic documentation. That's really what I do. I will give my clients some feedback if they're like, oh my God, what do I respond to this message? Look at this. I've lived it, so I can be like, frame it like this and send it to them. I'll do some of that like in the moment for certain clients, but most of my work is just like, let's organize what you have. Let's frame it in a way. Let's get it in one spot for you to be able to manipulate with your attorney for your case specifically. That's going to serve you through many different use cases, whether it's trial, whether it's with a PC, whether it's a GAL meeting, whether it's just a letter to opposing counsel. So your attorney has all the evidence at their fingertips in an organized way. I don't want to take work from an attorney. I don't pretend to be one. I don't have legal answers. I don't know. I'm just giving victims and litigants the tools so they can communicate more effectively with their attorney. A lot of family law attorneys are like single practice. They don't have good paralegals. They don't have any infrastructure. They may have someone that comes in that does like their books and they'll just be like, well, document it. And then the client's floundering and has no direction what to do. So I just make it pretty. I make it actionable.
and that is helpful in court. I mean, it really, really is.
It's a very grounding too. Because when you see it all in one spot in black and white, your brain is not like firing off in a million different directions. And you can really get like a 10,000 foot view of your case and all the different dynamics that play and what's going on. And you can be more strategic because I'm like, when you have all the facts organized for you, you can really sit down and look at it in a non-emotional way, as non-emotional as you can, and be like, okay, what is the best move I can make right now, given the facts of this case? You can't do that when it's scattered and you have a recording here and a screenshot there, and you have texts on your old computer that you haven't gotten off yet. I mean, I'm sure you hear that all the time.
Listen, I've had cases. It's one of the reasons why. Listen, I know that our Family Wizard is a great tool, and I know some people love hate it. It's a love hate relationship with
it. I love it, but it's not going to prove your case.
It's not going to prove your case. That being said, I would rather have our Family Wizard than have to coordinate text, emails, and like Instagram or WhatsApp messages all on the same date to prove, because that's I've had trials where I've had to do that, where I've had to pull up, okay, this is the text messages from this date. And just if you look at the emails, they correspond with the text messages. And oh, wait, there's WhatsApp from 2 days later, but they go back to the text messages. The benefit of OFW is it's all in one place. So I, for purposes of presenting in court, love our Family Wizard. And I will say this, I've had more trials that involve simply our Family Wizard. Because it's
a mountain of evidence.
It's amazing what people will put. Oh, y'all, do not send a message when you're angry. Do not send something when you get a pleading that makes you angry. Don't send something that says, you lying SOB, I can't believe you said that about me. And then here's the rule of thumb. If you know it's going to make your divorce attorney angry that you sent it, don't send it.
Yes. And I mean, it just goes back to the principle of like that I try to tell my clients, like you have to streamline things. Yeah, I get it. You don't want to talk to him at all. Okay, but do it in one spot. Stop texting him and then emailing him and then sending him the message here. Because to your point, that's an intentional tactic that makes it messy and harder to organize. So just do it in one spot.
Yep.
Pick a lane and stay in your lane.
And I don't know that I care what the lane is, so long as it's one lane.
Right. OFW, I mean, I've used it in my case for years. When people are like, oh my gosh, they're going to order OFW. Oh my gosh. But I'm like, it's the best thing ever. It's timestamped. You can see when they log in. If they don't log in and read your messages, there's no excuse because it's all timestamped. You can bring that up.
And you get notifications on your phone when you get a message. I have won cases based in part on the on the other party not timely reviewing OFW messages or reviewing everything around it but that message. It's very useful in court.
I do like it. I tell people they should use it. It's definitely a helpful tool, but I just want to say on your podcast, can we eliminate this? There's like this like wives' tale that there's people that monitor OFW. I'm like, there is no OFW police, because they're like, oh, the court sees it. I'm like, no, they
don't.
The
court does not see it. The court sees it when it's evidence in court. That's it.
People are like, oh, we got this app now. We have to communicate through it, and the court watches it. I'm like, who's who?
Okay, let's clear it up. The court does not monitor it. The court, in my understanding, cannot, because that would be the court getting its own evidence, which judges are prohibited from doing. The judges can see it when it's presented to them in court. Now, third-party professionals can be given access to your OFW. Can, not always. And so that happens as well, too. But there is no court police that looks at your OFW messages. The only way the court's ever going to see those messages is if they are presented to the court in court.
And guess what? If you're dealing with someone really abusive, because my evaluator did have third-party access during the evaluation, he sent the messages anyway. He did not care. He knew she was in there. And he would send them anyway. And then everyone's like, well, what about the tone meter? I'm like, what? I mean, I just have to laugh. I'm like, the red bar that pops up when you're nasty.
So that you can completely ignore?
I'm like, he saw it and hit send anyway. Like,
so Jake, to tell you what we mean. So in our Family Wizard, when you're sending a message to the parent, it has a tone meter. I know
like Wi-Fi bars.
It's told me to change some of my tone and my communications to my ex. But you can ignore it. And so you can write, you stupid son of a bitch. It'll say like alert, 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 whatever on bod. And you can still click, I don't care what you say, tone meter. I'm still hitting send.
It's interesting that it has guardrails like that. And Michelle, I can see how that could come in handy for you. We don't have an Our Family Wizard, Courtney, but we have a Lockstar Media text thread.
We do.
Which we have no handlebars on whatsoever, no seatbelts. So now I'm going to reframe that and understand what I'm looking at when I see these texts come through at like 3 a.m. And it's a hodgepodge.
You're still awake and I'm just waking up.
It's a hodgepodge of evidence of things. And I think this is the case in point here is I think we're learning very quickly that digital never goes away.
It never goes
away. Ever, ever. I don't care if it's Snapchat. I don't care if anything. If you have access to a phone, if you're putting things into that phone, if you have the phone on, things are going back and forth. Information is going back and forth. So I could understand in that heat of the moment how people could do these things. But I also think it's very interesting because further rationality goes out the window. People aren't really thinking what the outcome or the impact is going to be with their communication. I just find that fascinating how people are just so in their mood or their moment that they're not thinking of the impact of that stuff.
Listen, everything you put in writing is Exhibit A, people, everything.
Yep. And I tell my clients too, I'm like, listen, it's exhausting. They intend it to be exhausting to communicate with you. And I will say too, like a lot of these perpetrators or abusers, they usually have like a flavor or a platform or a currency, whatever term you want to use that they really care about. So like mine really loved the demeaning, degrading communication. Any communication with him was just a nightmare. So I knew that, like I had to prepare mentally to communicate with him. So I'll tell clients if they have a similar, you know, ex, if you can outsource that communication at all, a sister, a trusted friend, a best friend, even AI at this point, which is good and bad.
I'm going to have a whole caveat warning label like, on AI and using it.
But if you can just be like, how do I reply? Please take the emotion out of this. If you want to write back, like you're an SOB. But if you like, my sister's a licensed social worker and she had to take on communicating with him for a while in the app because I couldn't do it and I knew I could trust her. Again, proceed at your own risk because like Michelle said, anything digital is not going away. So if you get a friend that slugs wine every night in your OFW and she's like, fuck you, like you're screwed. Okay. You just screwed your own case. But
the clients themselves do it with the wine at 11.
Right.
I know if I'm seeing a message post 11 p.m., I'm going to be unhappy with that message as a general rule.
But like my sister, for when it was really bad, I was like, Kate, I was like a nervous wreck every time I saw the notification. It was just too much. I trusted her and she was like, I can take it on. It's fine. Do that. If you have to, absolutely do that for your own sanity if it gets that bad, okay? But like, they will have a flavor. So mine also loved third parties because he would be like, oh, this is a new person that I can convince she's lying. So I had to mentally prepare and work with my therapist. And again, you have to identify like what's the dynamic in my specific case and where do I need help and support? Don't be shy to lean on that help and support. I needed to really work with my therapist more. Or maybe I saw her more. I would plan sessions with her right before I had to go. Or right after with our co-parenting therapist or our PC, because I just knew it was going to be brutal. Yeah. There was other stuff he didn't really care about.
Yeah.
So you have to identify the patterns too in your case and try to get tools that will help you.
Did he know he was communicating with your sister?
No.
Okay. You have to have so much trust in that
person. Oh, yes, of course. That's what I'm saying. Like, proceed at your full own risk, but
Well, Michelle's a lawyer, and I don't know if I'd trust her to take over my text threads, to be fair.
Yeah,
and
I wouldn't trust
she's
you
a very
to take
powerful
over your
lawyer.
Text threads either, Jake.
No, if you represent me, yeah, but that's the thing. If Michelle does it and does something wrong and will take the fee and eat the fee, that's fine. But I don't, you know what I'm saying? Like everybody's, and I get it, your sister and she's a social worker, but you really have to trust somebody to take over your...
And you don't have to give over full access, but like, let's say I have two girlfriends that are divorced and it was bad divorces. And during that time, if I got a message, I would be like, I can't even read it. Can you just read it and filter it for me?
Yeah.
And they would be like, okay, this blah, blah, blah. And I'd be like, all right, just write back, blah, blah, blah. It took away, because what we talked about before, like going through all this evidence and just seeing it, seeing the name, seeing the stuff, the accusations, whatever, like they could filter out all that and just tell me what I need to reply to. reduce that emotional like trigger for me tenfold. So don't be shy about leaning into to things like that if you're in litigation and you are struggling emotionally, obviously.
Can I tell y'all honestly, like I know I've got, there's a couple attorneys that trigger me when they're opposing counsels, and I actually have my paralegal read me their emails or synthesize it for me before I actually read it because I know they'll trigger me. And so, I mean, if I have to do it in my daily life, it is completely reasonable and it should be normalized that you have someone that says, hey, that's going to trigger me. Can you please just, because then it's the, it softens the blow when you actually read it and you're not so angry. Right. I'm telling you, I've got some attorneys in particular that when they email me, can you synthesize it for me, Juan, please, before I read it, because it's going to make me angry.
You know, we tell that to stalking survivors, too, when they have to go through evidence and things that could be triggering, is to have someone else, a third party, look through those and analyze those things. So yeah, it's very interesting how these things overlap in that way.
Yeah. If you're a victim of DV or stalking or coercive control or any of it, sexual assault, too, lean into those people. And that sometimes I can help soften the burden with my clients too. I think it's like I said, I'll get messages and they're like, can you just please help me? I don't even know what to say. And almost just having that other voice or that help really helps soften that blow. You know, there were times, dark times during my litigation where I would have to open Our Family Wizard with my therapist on a Zoom, yeah, just to be able to be like, I can't even handle what's coming at me right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, unless you've lived it, right, it is hard to describe. Just, it's your gut drops. Like, you know, the proverbial, like your stomach, like just hits, yeah, the floor. Like when you were receiving that kind of barrage of ugliness, it hits you in the pit of your stomach, and it actually, to some people, makes them physically ill. Yeah. Like makes them physically ill. I'd be willing to bet, Courtney, that your health got a lot better post-divorce, huh?
It did. Uh-huh. And then when the litigation really, like,
it went down again.
Yeah. When I will say the custody evaluation is the best thing I ever did. And I know some people are really scared because there's so much fear mongering in this space too, which I think is also why I share my story, because I had, all things considering, a good family court outcome, if you will. That was hard. It's hard. It's not pretty. You know, you're divulging your life to someone that's reading all the nasty,
intimate details that, yeah, people only see the picket fence and the 2.5 kids and the dog and the cat and the nice cars in the driveway, and they don't see what happens behind closed doors. And when you're in the middle of this, that person is reading the intimate details of your life that even your family doesn't know.
Right.
It's very exposing.
Yes. But yes. And now, even, you know, now as we sit here today, despite everything that's gone on, you know, when I like travel with girlfriends, or I was just in Florida with a girlfriend of mine, and I'm like, I would never be able to do this stuff had I stayed. You know, on the trips my kids and I have been on, and just the memories and just the ease of life, being able to like do things without that dynamic, living in that relationship still is, like Michelle said, peace is priceless. Like that is priceless.
It is. It really is.
It's a shame I had to do everything to get here. But yeah, my health got tremendously better.
And it's one thing, like it's a shame I had to go through all those things to get to where we are, right? But I got to tell you, I'm almost grateful for it. Because I know from this side of it, I appreciate so much more what I'm having the ability to do, that I don't know that I would have had that same perspective if I hadn't have gone through those things. And I don't know that I've had some of the experiences to help others. And so, right, while I wouldn't wish it on anyone, it's a blessing in disguise in a lot of other ways. And I wouldn't be here with you, and I wouldn't be here talking with Jake, unless I'd gone through those things. And so from my perspective, I'm grateful, which has taken me a while to get to that place, because it's miserable when you think back and remember the things that your body helped you forget. And yes, yeah, I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but I'm glad it was my journey.
Yeah. And I think you asked my story, and yeah, I shared some of it, but then you also asked like, what was that line in the sand when you left?
Yeah.
And then the second line in the sand was when I decided I need to change how I approach this divorce. There were a few times, but the really the most important one was, things were bad. Obviously, I shared a glimpse, but they were bad. It was incessant, you know, holidays were a disaster. He wouldn't return the kids. He told the kids. The kids couldn't talk to me when they were with him for the 5-day stretch. They weren't allowed to call me. They weren't allowed to say my name. They weren't allowed to anything about me. It was just off limits, right? And then things got really bad and I had gotten another temporary restraining order. And he went to court and he was like, I'm filing an emergency order for the kids because she's crazy and she's making this all up and she's brainwashed the kids, you know, the whole playbook. She's alienating, blah, blah, blah. And I was like naively thinking I could just go to court and be like, well, no, he like abuses the kids. He screams at the kids. He sits the kids down and screams at them about everything that about me years later. And they would believe me and they didn't. And the judge ordered a temporary flip in custody, but I was really, my time was significantly reduced, like scarily reduced. And that's when we had to start the custody eval. And the second PC came on and we had family therapy and all that. They kind of threw the book at us. But that was a really big wake up call where I think I could have either gone one of two ways. I could have dug my heels in and been like, the family court wronged me. And, yeah. You know, this is horrible. And yes, the judge did make a bad decision. And for the record, she did apologize on the record. But I was like, this has to change. I have to somehow convey my truth because this is not working. And that's when I really just kind of developed this method and put it all on paper, like I said, and created that timeline. And it's been refined and refined as I've gone. But yeah, those were dark times for sure.
Yeah. And they're awful. Losing custody of your kids or having your time substantially reduced when you know you didn't do anything wrong is awful. And you have to look at, and you're right, you can do one of two things. You can say the family law system is terrible, I'm going to bring down the whole system, and in the process you lose your kids. Or you figure out how to navigate that system and present your evidence. And I frame it as putting a puzzle together. Because what you have to do for the court ultimately is put the accurate picture together, which is putting a puzzle. Because a lot of times in family courts, you're having a small hearing, a small hearing, a small hearing. Those are just pieces, right? It's not the whole puzzle. And so when you get to final trial, you have to articulate to the court the puzzle. And that's where how you present the evidence matters. That's when how you've collected the evidence matters, because you want to make that puzzle as clear as it can be. And that is when you're talking to attorneys that do this. I mean, that's what we do. I mean, I have to artfully put the puzzle together for the court to see what is really going on. Also means, by the way, that you own your own stink, because to go in there to say I'm perfect and yep. I didn't make any mistakes and that person's the terrible person and I should win, they should lose, is not the answer either. You got to own your own stink when you're putting that puzzle together, because that also lends credibility to the picture you're trying to paint.
I tell people that too. I'm like, listen, not everyone's perfect. The abuser, they're going to act perfect because they feel like they are and they feel justified in what they've done. So if you can have some humility and just be like, I made a mistake and I learned, that will serve you tenfold. Yep. And I noticed that in my evaluation. The evaluator really wanted to talk through to both of us, how could you have handled this better?
Yep.
What could have been better? What could have been different? And to go in there and say, nothing, I'm perfect, nothing. I'm perfect, I'm not going to change, would have really, you shoot yourself in the foot.
Oh, you kill your case. You absolutely kill your case.
And then two, I tell people, we're collecting the evidence, we're putting it in a cohesive timeline or format, and we're going to follow that. We're going to show, but we're not going to tell. That's the principle I always follow. Here's everything.
Yep.
You guys are the experts. Help me make this better.
Yep.
You're not going to go in there and say, he's a narcissist, he's an abuser, he's horrible, I've diagnosed him, the DSM-5 says this personality disorder, and everyone weaponizes those damn terms now. And I'm like,
Not everyone is a narcissist. Just because you have narcissistic traits doesn't mean you're a narcissist.
Right. I'm like, don't do that. Show, do not tell.
Exactly.
Show, do not tell.
That could not be better advice. Don't go into court and say that you've self-diagnosed them, that there's terrible SOD. No. Just show what's been going on, because if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, looks like a duck, it's a duck.
I'm like, listen, the judge on the bench wants to come to that conclusion. I've had people come to me after working with other coaches and whatever, and they're like, well, they told me to to send the evaluator like an article on coercive control. I'm like, no.
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 No, 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 no.
The only thing you're sending the evaluator is evidence to support your claims.
Oh, that's it.
Or refute theirs.
It's just
you
exhibits.
You are not there to educate them.
It's just exhibits. Y'all, do not send them articles. Tell them how to do their job. You want to lose? That's a good way to do it.
I'm like, no. So that's a big principle that I follow. I'm like, we are showing, we're not telling, like we're in kindergarten.
I like that. I'm actually going to steal that from you and include it into my repertoire.
Good.
And we have done a record that Michelle's going to steal something. But
listen, so lawyers are great at stealing and making it their own. We do it all the time. We are not reinventing the wheel at all.
Courtney,
they control through the chaos. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you decided to start your company, and you've been obviously public with your story, that's basically part of the mission is that I've gone through this and I want to help other people. Were you concerned at all that you were sort of being too transparent? Because a lot of times that also, because you're still dealing with this stuff, was there any sort of concern that you were in a position where you needed to get your story across, but also could be opening yourself up to potential more conflict with your ex?
Yeah. And I mean, I've definitely felt, I think, a little bit of that for sure. I waited so long to start talking about it. Like I said, I mean, this has been going on for years. It wasn't until after we finished all this evaluation type stuff that I really started to talk about it. I was in a much more secure place. And I don't say that to deter people, but you have to be smart about it, obviously. I spoke out in ways where maybe it was more protected. Like I did a lot of advocacy work for the coercive control bill that passed in New Jersey. So I was doing a lot of, you know, reaching out to lawmakers and sharing parts of my story with them for sure. But yeah, there's always that worry. I mean, I try to keep a lot of what the kids experienced private when I do all these podcasts and stuff, because that's their story to share, you know? But it had become, I mean, I live in a really small town, and unfortunately, so much had gone on so publicly that so many people already knew anyway. And I felt at a certain point, I was almost doing a disservice to other people by not sharing. Because when I did share it with people, or like friends would give friends numbers, they're like, oh my God, I'm going through the same thing. This is crazy. And then I started to realize that these bad actors just, they have the same playbook. It's like crazy. They all do the same or very similar stuff. That I was like, I have to share some of my story. And honestly, I'm only sharing like, this is like the tip of the iceberg. There's so much that has gone on. It's sad. I'm not laughing to make light of it, but it's just sometimes when I look back, I'm like, if I don't laugh, I would cry. I would just be in a corner.
It goes back to sometimes you have to find humor in dark places because it's the only way to survive. I mean, and it sounds terrible, but when you go through these things, right, it is dark. It is soul shattering. It's soul breaking. I mean, it is designed to break you and break your spirit. That's what it's designed to do. And you have to find something to hold on to help you get through it. And for each person, there's a unique way to get through it. For me, it's humor. Give me stand-up comedy about any day of the week. I make terrible jokes all the time because it's about surviving and getting through and finding some happiness in the dark places, because you got to find something to hold on to. Whatever that is for you, whatever it is for the people that are listening, you got to find something and hold on to it.
Yeah. And when I get messages from people that listen to my podcast or I've worked with or that I've helped and they're saying like your story helped, oh my gosh, you're talking about what I'm living through, thank you so much, that really keeps me going. And then also, you know, there came a point in my life where my kids were getting older and they were starting to realize, to your point, Michelle, like around middle school, 10, 11, 12, like light bulbs start going off, and they were coming to me not even about the issues between their dad and I, but issues with peers or teachers or coaches or friends. And I'm like, how can I possibly model for them that that's not okay when this is going on in our personal life? So that's kind of what really, I guess, started for me, like the desire and the willingness to start sharing my story. Because I'm like, listen, at the end of the day, if he didn't want me to talk about this or this to be our story, there were a lot of things that could have gone differently that I didn't do.
Yep. And it's what you put out in the public record and the public forum. Fair game.
Right. We actually had case law in New Jersey thing. Praise the Lord that protected victims of DV and domestic violence and protected victims in general, because there was a woman who had a restraining order and I guess she shared in the community. She was Jewish and she shared within the Jewish community, and her ex anyway ended up going and getting a restraining order against her, saying her talking about it was harassing him.
I want to know the judge that signed that restraining order that said that. I mean, that.
So the appellate division handed down a wonderful decision that said victims are absolutely protected. They're allowed to share their story.
Well, First Amendment people.
I know. So once that came out, I think people felt a little bit better, because there's also so much out there that scares victims into silence and just like that you can't talk about it because your kids are going to get ripped out of your house and taken away from you. So I also wanted to kind of rip that Band-Aid and I guess peel back the veil a little bit. Lift the veil behind, you can share your story in ways that are helping others. Why not? And again, you know, sometimes people may criticize me for sharing it, but like, do you think I really want to get on here and talk about this stuff at the end of the day? It's not that pretty.
It's not that.
Anybody that meets me can certainly Google me and see, and they're like, oh shit, this girl's been through a lot, you know? So listen, there's pros and cons, but at the end of the day, I feel like when I lay my head down at night on my pillow, I feel like I'm making a difference. So I continue doing it.
You both board clients in various states of distress, right? So if a client is to approach either of you, do you have something that would make it easier for you to sort of ingest that information or sort of put something together in an expedited process? Or do you have any preference on how a client comes to you, what they should expect, or what stage they're in their current divorce or custody battle?
I mean, ideally, I would love them from the beginning, because it's so, I find, but I say beginning, and I really shouldn't say that, because when you're in a relationship like this, that would mean day one in the relationship. Because even divorce, when you start a divorce, if there's abuse allegations and someone's going to really go for custody and in the divorce process, you're going to have to go back through the whole relationship anyway. So I guess at the start of divorce litigation, I should say, it's hard. The longer it goes on, obviously, the harder it is to organize their evidence, because there's just so much. So if I can, you know, kind of cut that off at the pass and get them earlier in the litigation, it's better. Because I, like I said, my whole thing is just based on, let's implement an easy system. We're going to document it. We're going to have a spreadsheet. We're going to have tags. We're going to have drop downs. We're going to have things pre-filled so you don't have to spend a ton of time. We're going to make this as easy as possible. We're going to set up a Dropbox or a Google Drive structure that you can manage. We're going to drop your proofs in there. You're going to set it. You're going to forget it. But it's going to be somewhere, and you're going to have a naming convention. So this is easy. I'm going to name this the date or whatever naming convention. I'm going to write up myself a little note on my spreadsheet, and then maybe every month or every week we go back and we kind of tweak that or refine it. But they get themselves in a habit of just doing it as time goes on, so it's much more manageable. But I have helped people. I have a few clients that I've helped after they've gotten horrible final orders to turn their case around. So it's never too late. Ideally, though, of course, early in the litigation, because it's re-traumatizing to go through it all, too. It is.
It is, because the body does a great way of helping you forget.
Yes.
So that you can survive. And then when you have to go back through it all, and then you start remembering things that you had completely forgotten about, it very much is triggering and difficult for the clients to go through. I mean, I agree with Courtney. It's so ideal to start it at the beginning. But for me, it really depends on the type of case. Also depends on the personality of the client, right? Because some clients aren't capable of doing it in particular ways. So you have to find what works best for them. And that's why, at least from my perspective, I have a fabulous paralegal who helps get them organized, right? And so some of them, I come in and Michelle, here's kind of, I'd be willing to bet Courtney's probably helped some of them, because they come in with a tabbed outline format. You click on the link, pulls up the supporting evidence. I wish all my clients did it. It makes my job so much easier, and it also makes it less expensive for my clients, because again, I'm not reading screenshots. Screenshots on text messages are the most aggravating thing for me to have to do, because when I look at evidence, I look at how I'm going to get it into court. And screenshots for me can be some difficult ones to get in, because if they're not timestamped appropriately, you don't see who the factual phone number is from. Like, it's cut off. So under optional completeness, judge, there's not all of it. One of the big things I tell clients, go, if you have an iPhone in particular, go get iMazing and PDF the entirety of your phone messages. And so that makes it much easier for me, because if it's a PDF, I can make it searchable for terms. And so then you can tab those terms in the PDF. And so I've been in trial, y'all, where I've got their 2,000 pages of text messages, but I've got all the tabs on the side to highlight all the important parts. And I click, 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 click through the exhibit. And so some of the other part of it is remembering, and I'm no doubt Courtney does this, but it goes back to my KISS method, keep it simple, stupid. Like, sometimes the simplest exhibit is the most powerful. And one example that I use, that we use in court occasionally, is like the possession schedule one. So when you've got a parent that doesn't exercise like they're supposed to screw with the other parent. So I'll get a 12-month calendar and I tell my clients to use giant X's for every day they have the child. And that's a really simple way to show a court, here, judge, here's what's going on.
My favorite is the screenshots where they'll send me stuff and it's like yesterday. I'm like, what is yesterday?
Oh, I hate yesterday. I'm like, I can't, or today. I'm like, I can't anything with that in court.
I'm like, but then you're going to have to set an alarm to remember in 2 days to go back to get the date, like just export it as a PDF. And then, like you said, we can search, we can color code, we can tag it a certain behavior and put it in the folder with the rest of those demeaning language. Here, send your lawyer. Your lawyer wants to see how he's communicating with you. Okay, we're going to send her 50 dates and 50 examples in PDF format of the messages where he's demeaning to you. Isn't that a lot easier than, oh my God, you know, crying, sending random screenshots, one-off screenshots to the lawyer? I'm like, that's not going to land.
It doesn't help. Like, it doesn't help. You have to show a consistent pattern of behavior. And one, you're a see you next Tuesday isn't going to get me there.
Right. And back to like the instant gratification, I see it so much. And I don't know if it's a cultural thing in family court. I think some of it is like pushed by the family court lawyers too, some of the bad actors, because there are those. But it's like, I tell clients, and I know it's completely different, but I'm like, look at some criminal cases. Let's just look. Investigators will spend years, months collecting evidence before they make a move. That is what you have to do. Just because you're not doing anything and you're not in court fighting does not mean that your case is dead or your position is like stale or bad or whatever. Like, you still are strategizing. Every time you communicate with him, if he's an abuser, guess what? That's evidence. Every single email that I had with my ex was evidence against him. I could email him, the sky is blue, and he'd be like, F you, die in a ditch, you suck, you're the worst mother ever. I mean, that's evidence.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, you have to look at it, and I hate to say it's a war, but with those types of individuals, it's a war. And you don't need to win every battle, you just need to win the war. And sometimes you want to lose some of the battles to win the ultimate war.
Right.
I mean, it sounds...
Sorry, Jake.
No, please go.
No, I'm good. I'll shut up.
That wasn't my objective. Courtney, once a client, let's say, completes your program, right, the Monarch Method, generally, what do they feel? What do they go through? What's their experience been like?
They're always like, I'm so glad I did this, even though I didn't want to, because I feel like I can finally see the forest through the trees, right? Or whatever the saying is. Like, they can also process the trauma and kind of almost like put it to bed. It's like, you're going to close that file box. You have everything now. It's like a safety blanket. Put it on the shelf, like my therapist says. And if you need it, if a letter comes through, if a motion gets filed, if he starts making false allegations, you open the file cabinet, you have it all right there, and then you do it. So they feel a sense of like security. They feel more confident because they know the facts. They're not all frazzled and they can really advocate for themselves better and they can communicate with their attorney better. They're not, you know, disjointed and all over the place. I like seeing clients who come to me completely unsure and frazzled and scared and transform into like a more secure, well-spoken, articulate version of themselves that have fact-based documents behind them that can support their position, whatever that position is.
Courtney, I was going to say, you've been absolutely delightful and amazing. And I hope to continue this conversation further, because I would suspect we could probably talk for hours and hours and hours. Can you tell people where they can find you?
Yes, they can find me on Instagram. I am on Instagram. I'm public. I keep my page open so people can reach out. Monarch Consulting Group is online. I offer free complimentary consultations to anyone who's interested. And you can find me on a ton of different podcasts if you search. So,
well, I'm going to say this as someone that has done this now for 24 years. It is nice to find someone that is helping in the manner in which you do, because evidence is key to every case we put on in court, and helping people organize their evidence and teaching them how to collect their evidence is something that is so helpful. So, I mean, really, I love it when the clients come and organize and say, here's your packet and here are all the tabs and just click on these links. Makes my job so much easier, makes my presentation so much more effective. So thank you for the work that you do in helping your clients, because it makes jobs for attorneys like me much easier. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Love Lust Law. Want to reach out? Want to find out more about what's going on with me? You can follow me at Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke. You can also email me at hello@michellelocke.com. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that. Have a great one.